I will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon sponsors. If you'd like to become a Patreon sponsor for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, please go to our website, which is bodybuildinglegendsshow.com, and you'll see the link for the Patreon donor in the upper right-hand corner. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we have a guest, Nicholas Kemla, who is an author, and he wrote the book Mr. America. That's M-I-S-T-E-R, spelled out Mr. America. And this is a book Nicholas wrote in French, because he is from France, several years ago, back in 2017, I believe. And it has just been recently released in English, and it is available on Amazon. I'll have the link down below in the description if you guys want to order it. And this is a biography about Mike Mentzer, but it's written as a novel. So it's very, very interesting. It's a 600-page book, and it's basically the story of Mike Mentzer's journey from beginning in Pennsylvania all the way when he started bodybuilding, and then his journey all the way up to the heights of bodybuilding, winning the Mr. Universe and taking second in the Mr. Olympia, and working for Joe Weider for many years, and introducing, of course, the heavy-duty training system, which was based on the principles started by Arthur Jones with the Nautilus. Then Mike's subsequent decline after the 1980 of Mr. Olympia, where he had many problems in his life, and then he had some substance abuse problems, and then made it sort of a comeback with the personal training, and then eventually passed away at the age of 50 in 2001. So it's a really, really interesting book. Nicholas sent it to me just last week, so I was able to read some of it. Of course, I didn't read all of it, but I'm interested in reading the whole thing. It's very well written. And like I said, it's not just a typical biography. It's written as a novel. And Nicholas found it so interesting when he started delving into the life of Mike Mentzer and all the different characters that were in the bodybuilding world, including, of course, Arnold and Joe Weider, Arthur Jones. And he thought it would run like a good novel. So I never read a novel about a bodybuilder's life before, but it's gotten rave reviews over in France. And like I said, it's just been released just this week on Amazon, and it is now finally in English. So we have a really interesting interview with Nicholas. In fact, we talked for so long, it's going to be two parts. So this is going to be part one of the book, where Nicholas delves into it and talks about why he decided to write this book. He's a very interesting person, as most writers are, and very literate. We have a long interview with Nicholas coming up in a minute. All right. What else is going on out there, guys? Summer is now over. Happy Labor Day for everybody out there. Not much going on here in Florida. It's still hot, but looking forward to the winter when we have our nice weather. At the end of our interview with Nicholas, I am going to read an article. This is the first article I can remember reading about Mike Mentzer, and it is from the April 1976 issue of Muscle Builder and Power. And it was an interview with Mike done by Gene Mose. And it's called Mentzer's Contraction Control Training. And this was basically Mike's introduction to the bodybuilding world. He just took, I believe, third place in the 1975 Mr. America contest. I think Robbie won that contest, the IFBB America. And I believe Roger Callard was second. And Mike was in third, but this was basically his introduction to the national scene, even though he had competed as a teenager in the AAU Mr. America back in 1971. This was Mike's comeback to bodybuilding. And Joe Weider recognized his potential and actually put him on the cover of the magazine. So at the end of our article with Nicholas, because I believe we mentioned this article in our interview, I'm going to read this article for you guys. So it's kind of a short article, but it's pretty interesting going back to when Mike Mentzer was introduced to the bodybuilding public. All right, I did get one email from you guys. It says, "Hey, John, I just wanted to share some positive feedback with you. I've been a longtime listener to your podcast, and I'm still catching up on the content. I first started listening to your podcast during lockdown when everything was closed down, and the only way for me to exercise was to go for long walks. I later bought your MP6 workout book and did that workout for several months. But in March, my wife and I had a baby, so I switched to less frequent workouts, So I don't have so much spare time, and I've adopted the Mike Mentzer HIT training, and I'm enjoying the results. Keep the podcast going, whether it's interviews, magazines, or the great conversations with Jerry Branum. All the best, Chris from Munich, Germany. All right. Thank you, Chris. Thanks for listening and keeping it up in Munich, Germany. That's great. I also got some more videos up on my YouTube channel. So, guys, if you're not subscribed to my YouTube channel, go over to YouTube. It's under my name, John Hansen, and I've got more interviews coming up there every week. I'm trying to put a couple videos up from interviews that we've done of the podcast every week, and I've also got my John Hansen Fitness videos going up, too. I'm trying to put one or two of those up every week, so a lot of stuff going up over on YouTube. And I was on Olympia TV last week. I did an interview. It was a joint interview with Ron Harris and Tarek Elgindy, who was the host. Also, Sean Ray was there and Bob Ciccarillo. And we were talking about the upcoming Mr. Olympia, which will be coming up in October. It's the 20th Mr. Olympia, so it's going to be a really big event. And they're really promoting it heavily. It's going to be out in Las Vegas. So, yeah, we did the interview there. And then also I've got my Muscle Maturity podcast with Samir Banut. And that is on the Old School Labs channel. So if you guys are looking for those, we usually do those every week on Friday. It's usually out every Friday. All right. So that's all I got for our intro. So let's get to our interview with Nicholas Kemla, who is the author of the new book, Mr. America. And this will be part one of our interview, and we'll have part two next week. Here we go. All right. Welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I have a special guest with us this week, Mr. Nicholas Kemla, who just wrote a new book about Mike Mentzer called Mr. America. And Nicholas is joining us from France. So thanks for joining us on the show, Nicholas. It's great to have you on.
Thanks for having me. Thank you, John.
So this book is an amazing book. You sent me the PDF of it this week. I got a chance to read a little bit of it, you know. Mike Mentzer is super popular still. That's amazing, isn't it? That he's been passed away since 2001. Even with the younger crowd today, people are still really interested in Mike Mentzer. People who weren't even born, I think, when Mike passed away 20-something years ago.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, he's a fascinating character. I mean, I don't know that he has that huge a following today, but there's definitely a strong community of, even as you said, younger guys who are fascinated by his life story and his approach to bodybuilding as a discipline, but also, you know, the way to practice it.
Yeah.
And I think it comes down to his personality, his writing, and also, of course, the whole rivalry with, you know, between the Arnold way and the Mike Mentzer way.
So yeah.
Obviously today, you know, one has won. But Mike's voice is still, you know, still somewhere in the background, and, you know, and trying to explain that there may be another way.
Yeah. Now, when did the book originally come out? Because it was released in France first, right?
Yeah. So the book was published early 2019.
Okay.
So that was like 5 years ago. It was my first novel. Because I mean, yeah, we haven't said it, but it's Mike's story, but it's like a Hollywood biopic. It's a biographical novel, so
yeah.
I tell Mike's story from Mike's point of view, and it's his whole life story from, you know, when he's 11, basically when he first sees a bodybuilding magazine with Bill Burr on the cover, all the way down to his death, you know, in 2001. So that's why I say it's a novel. So it was published in 2019, and it took 5 years to come out in the US for many reasons that if you can go through later.
And it got great reviews. I noticed some of the French magazines out in France were really, really, people who weren't even bodybuilders were really complimenting the book.
Yeah, I mean, that was my ambition was, I wanted to pay a tribute to Mike. I mean, I've never met him, obviously, but, you know, when I found out about his life and his story, and I was completely fascinated and impressed by everything that he was. And I was like, this guy deserves a proper story. And I didn't want to make a book that would only talk to bodybuilding fans, because everyone who's interested in bodybuilding, if they want to find stuff about Mike Manzer, now they will. I mean, there's plenty of resources online where you can read, guys who trained with him, and they would say, oh, he was like this and he was like that, and there's a few pictures in there. But that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to really show as many people as possible why he was so fascinating, even outside of the bodybuilding world. Like, this guy, his whole life story, all the way to the top and then all the way down to the bottom.
Right.
Because literally the bottom, like, as he died almost forgotten after many, many mental issues and, problems with the laws, etc. So this whole life story, to me, it was telling something about the world today. And, when I first found out about what had been going on between Arnold and him, I was like, how can, what does it say about the world that Arnold has won? Not just the Olympia. Arnold has won everything. He's won everybody's hearts. I mean, look at it today. He's, even for people who were not Arnold's fan when they were kids, which is my case. I mean, I grew up worshiping Arnold. I saw Terminator and Conan and, all his movies like a million times.
Yeah.
But now even people who have never been Arnold fans, they see him as a great character on Instagram and on Twitter. And, he's very vocal and he's fighting for freedom and peace or whatever, and he won everything. And so what does that say of our world today that a guy like him, and who himself says he's a manipulator, he's a master at psychological warfare, he admits to all sorts of devious ways to get what he wants.
Yeah.
Why do we worship him that much? I mean, what does it say of the world that today he is a hero like he is now?
Yeah, that's a great point. So when you found out about Mike, were you into bodybuilding?
I was. I spent a lot of time at the gym. Yeah,
okay.
But I wouldn't say what is being a bodybuilder. I don't know, but yeah, I was seriously training. Never, never on any scale comparable to guys who compete or whatever.
Yeah.
But I did a lot of different sports in my life, and it took me a while to come out as a muscle fan and a bodybuilding fan. At some point in my life, I was like, okay, I'm not training for a rowing race, or I'm not training because I want to, climb walls or whatever. I'm training because I want to get bigger and, more cut. That's quite a journey, to get there when when it's not part of your universe. But so, yeah, I mean, and at some point I had a personal trainer who himself, because before I started writing books, I mean, I had a career in advertising. I was working, crazy hours. And so at some point I had a personal trainer, and that guy was a regional champion back in the 80s in Mike Menzer's years.
Okay.
In France. And I was wearing a tank top that had Mike Menzer's silhouette on it. I had never heard of Mike Menzer. I didn't know who he was.
Yeah.
I had just found that tank top online because I was looking for something a little bit like vintagey and, long hair, mustache, really cool. And so my personal trainer, who is now a good friend, he said, oh, but that's Mike Menzer. I was like, who? And he told me the whole story. And I was like, wow, that is fascinating. And at first, I didn't even believe him. I was like, that must be bullshit. I mean, how would I never have heard of that guy if everything you say is true? How is that even possible? And, I started digging online and I found out the whole thing. And that's how.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Was your trainer telling you about Mike's bodybuilding history or about his training or both?
Oh, the whole thing. He told me about the way of training, the sort of like your revolutionary approach of intensity. And then he told me about his life. I mean, what's the expression in English? Not the details, but basically what I said, he was super famous
and
forgotten and ruined. And of course he told me about the rivalry with Arnold, but that was enough Yeah, he also told me that Mike wrote a lot, which is something that's very important, and that's helped me a lot in my own writing. You know, he told me how smart Mike was. You know, whatever we may think about, people may think about his training ways, it's undeniable that he was a unique voice in the whole world of bodybuilding. The way he wrote and his desire to write articles that were, you know, they talked about the ways of training, but referencing them with philosophical quotes or, you know, his own personal history. He had a very unique voice in that sense. It was very, 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 very personal, and at the same time, very universal. And I thought that was fascinating that there was a guy like that who could reach that level of bodybuilding competing. And he was, I mean, he was worshipped the world over, you know, like from Japan to South Africa to Germany, everywhere. At one point in the early 80s, late 70s, he had fans, like thousands of them.
Yeah, the first muscle builder I ever bought when I was a kid, as I was just getting into bodybuilding, had Mike on the cover. And I think it was the first muscle builder magazine that Mike was ever on. And I remember in the interview, he had just placed third, I think, in the IFBB Mr. America. And the writer was asking him about his training. And they were doing the typical interview that they always did with all these guys. And everybody back then was training 6 days a week, doing 20 sets of body part. And Mike said he was training like 3 days a week, doing five sets of body part. And the writer couldn't believe him, you know?
Well, I actually mentioned that interview in the book, and it was the guy who interviewed him was Armand Tani.
Armand,
Yeah, so great guy from even earlier
Definitely.
than Mike, you know, the 50s and early 60s. He was working for Weider, and in that interview, actually, not only did Mike say that he was only training 3 times a week for 20, 30 minutes a week. And so Dave Mastoriakis, who helped me write the book, I mean, he literally opened the door to not only his heart, but also his memory, and you know, put me in touch with a lot of guys that, you know, were kind enough to grant me some of their time. But Dave was actually there at the interview, and he told me, he said, Armand, like, literally dropped his pen. He was like, that can't be possible. You know, and Mike said, no, it is. And Dave said, well, yeah, I mean, we train together. That's literally what we do. Nothing more, nothing less. Then Mike went even further, and he said, in a year from now, I will be as good as Arnold. And that was actually the headline of the article. I think the article was called Mike Menzer, Superstar of the Future. And underneath it, there was the quote from Mike saying, in 1 year from now, I'll be as good as Arnold. And Armand told Mike, he said, are you sure you want me to print this? Arnold said, yeah. Mike said, yeah, it's nothing. I mean, so Arnold was like, sorry, Armand was telling Mike, he said, well, you know, I mean, do you really believe that? And Mike said, well, it's not about beliefs. It's not about what I believe. It's about science. I train that many hours a week. Arnold train that much, you know, per week. And so if you just literally do the calculation, it's just like it's scientific. From 1 year from now, I will be as good as Arnold. And Arnold warned Mike and said, well, you know, he's not going to like it, because Arnold had already retired at the time. So I think it was 1977. But he was already, you know, he was getting ever bigger outside of bodybuilding and within the bodybuilding world, controlling the IFBB events, organizing the IFBB events and stuff.
Mr. Olympia.
And he already had a reputation of someone who was, you know, very much a control freak about what was said about him and who was a threat to his reign. So, and yes, well, Mike said, yeah, print it, and they did, and we all know what that led to.
It's amazing that Arnold was so controlling of his image, but I guess he was just trying to make money. Even though he had retired, you would think he wouldn't really care about someone new coming up, you know, and he would welcome these new guys coming up. But I think when like you said, when Mike started criticizing his training style, Arnold took it very personally, and he took it as an attack towards him.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I go through a lot of that in the book, the psychological mindsets you know, very different worldviews, Arnold and Mike, very different personalities. And, you know, Mike was from, you know, all I've heard. So I think maybe we should say that, you know, I talked to Bill Pearl, I talked to Boyko, I talked to John Baelic, I talked to Dorian Yates. Who else did I talk to? I mean, I spent a lot of time interviewing guys who had spent time with Mike at various periods of his life. And of course, the main two people who really helped me were also his main two friends, you know, Dave Mastoriakis and John Little, himself a writer. I mean, I'm sure your viewers and listeners know of him. Great guy too, great personality, very, very smart, very wise. I mean, and they both, you know, they both had spent a lot of time with Mike. And so they said Mike was very straightforward. Mike, you know, and in, I guess, so I spent a lot of time living in the States. I have a lot of American friends. And, you know, in America, it's a little bit like in England. There's a tendency to round the angles without sounding too, you know, and you round the angles and you, there are ways that to say things, you know, that maybe in France we are a bit more, you know, direct, I would say. And Mike didn't have that. Mike was very direct from what I've been told. And also, I mean, you can see it in the way he writes. I mean, when you read his articles, he's very straightforward. He doesn't round up the angles. He doesn't try to soften or care for the sensitivities of whoever he's talking to. And so I think that that didn't help. You know, no matter what Arnold's personality was and no matter how touchy he was about his own image, the fact that Mike was so, you know, violently banging against the wall with no concern for offending this or that. There's an article that I quote a lot in the book from Ricky Wayne, so another guy from way back when. Great champion. Also, many years a writer for Wheeler. He actually wrote a great book, which I'm sure you've read. I think it was called Muscle Wars.
Muscle Wars, yeah.
Very interesting. That was a great resource for me in my writing. And so Ricky Wayne, at the time when Mike, you know, started becoming bigger in every sense of the word, he compared Mike to a butcher slaughtering all the sacred cows that mom, you know,
that came before in bodybuilding.
So that's, I mean, you know, that's literally how he was perceived. And so that doesn't help. What I'm trying to say is that it doesn't really help making friends, you know, and also the world of, I think the world of bodybuilding, but especially, you know, in California around Gold's Gym at the time, it was very much a little court around the king. You know, Arnold was the king, and there was this, there's this culture, but it's the same in every community, not just in bodybuilding. You know, people do things because the most powerful guy tells them that that's the way to do it. And in bodybuilding, you add to that that whoever is the biggest has the truth, knows the truth. So everyone follows the word of whoever is the bigger guy. And no one, you know, ever thought to challenge that. And of course there was Arthur Jones, you know, but he was not really part of that world. And a lot of people didn't really pay attention to what he was saying. But then all of a sudden you have Mike coming, you know, to the stage and starting saying, that doesn't make sense. Like, this is what you're doing. You're wasting your time. It's counterproductive. You're overtraining. And so, of course, I mean, that blows the whole thing up. And people don't like being told that that they've been doing wrong for, you know, God knows how many years. And also, I think one thing with bodybuilding is that, you know, as long as you get bigger and you get, you know, more cuts, you don't really see why it would be what you're doing is wrong, because it seems to work. Like, but we all know that it has not that much to do with exactly how you work. I mean, it's a lot about the diet and the supplements and, you know, I don't want to get too controversial. But so Mike was saying, I'm not saying it doesn't work. I'm just saying you could achieve that same results a lot quicker without spending your whole life in the gym. And that's where he's a philosopher, because a lot of people were like, why would I want to spend less time in the gym? You know, they didn't have a perception that there was a whole world out there of saying, you know, why are you put on earth?
Yeah.
What for?
Yeah.
Is that really all you want to do with your life?
Right.
You know, books to read, movies to watch,
right.
Museums to
Good
visit,
job, family, right?
And for Mike, that was a key issue. It was like, there are so many other things to do with our life, you know, which is a gift, you know, whether you're a believer or not. I mean, you have this unique opportunity to live in the one planet in the whole universe where there is air to breathe and, you know, flowers to see and, you know, just do something else with your life. Don't spend 6 hours a day, 6 days a week at the gym.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think, too, what was different between Mike and, like, Arthur Jones, who had the same philosophy, but Mike was winning contests and he had a contest winning physique. And so he was proving it. You know, every year he was coming back, he's getting better, he's getting better. And I think that's when people really started to buy into his way of thinking, you know. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember, like, when I was a kid, like you said, everybody was doing the traditional 6 days a week of, you know, high sets of training. And then when Mike was questioning that, I remember the one thing he said that I kind of resonated with. He was saying, like, you can't sprint a mile. You can either train hard or you can train long. You know, you can pace yourself and do 20 sets, just like you have to pace yourself to do a mile. But if you're going to go all out, you're going to really train hard, you're only going to be able to do a limited amount of sets. And that made a lot of sense. And I remember seeing it, like, in the gym, like my friends in the gym, everybody started cutting back. Everybody was listening to him, and they might not have only done like one or two sets of body part like he was doing, or an exercise, but they were hearing what he was saying and they were taking that in. And he really did. I always said this, Mike really did change bodybuilding back in the late 70s. You know, he changed the whole philosophy of training. And he really brought in this whole new concept of training harder and not longer.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And it was all, you know, coming from the Arthur Jones writing and his experiments and his machines and the invention of, you know, Nautilus, of course, as you know, and the Colorado experiment, the Casey Viator. His own very short career, I mean, even though he did come back later on, but you know what I mean? Like, so Mike was kind of like taking all that. And as you said, he had that physique and he had the personality and he had the sense of putting it all in writing and, you know, and in talks and mail order courses. And so, people started listening. And what I think is a little sad is that, I mean, I still follow, you know, that world, and I still go to the gym, you know, and on Instagram and on YouTube. I mean, it seems to have all been, you know, wiped away. Like a lot of. So, I mean, yes, we started that video by saying that he still has quite a big following, and but it's still so minor. I mean, it's still so little compared to all those guys. And again, I'm not going to name names, but, you know, the guys who have huge followings on YouTube, on Instagram, wherever, you know, and a lot of them, they've never heard of him. If they have, all they have to say is that he was a loony and he was crazy and that didn't work. He lost and Arnold won. And that's that, you know, that's the end of it. There's no debate. You know, harder, you know, no pain, no gain, the harder, you know, and it's like, wait a second, why don't you see back? And, you know, even I have a chiropractor because I had a shoulder injury, which had nothing to do with high intensity training. Yeah, because that's another thing that a lot of people say. It's like, oh, no, that's a sure way to get hurt.
Right.
Like,
right.
Well, wait a second. I mean, everyone else who trains without high intensity, they still get hurt. And you don't say, well, that's just get hurt. Anyway, so, and that chiropractor, he's into CrossFit, you know, He's maybe 27, 28, Instagram generation, YouTube generation, and he thinks he knows. He thinks I'm a very old school guy, because I'm twice his age. He never heard of Mike Manzer. He's heard of high intensity, but high intensity interval training, which is not a, it's
Are
not the
you?
same
Yeah,
as high
right.
intensity training. So he thinks, like, he presents to me things like what you call it, isometrics,
Yeah.
like it's a new thing. I'm like, I really think you should read my book, because you'll find out that way back in the 50s there was already, we haven't talked about Dr. Ziegler, which is a big character in the book, and he played a big role in Mike's life, I mean, him and Bob Hoffman were crazy about isometrics, and that was the whole thing. They
Yeah,
sold
Bob Hoffman was right.
tens of thousands of books about how it was going to be. But so my point is, these young kids, they think they know because they follow guys on YouTube or Instagram with millions of followers, and the guy looked ripped, and but they have no clue where it comes from. They have, no idea of the whole history behind it. And basically, they're reinventing the wheel every new generation. And I'm like, you're wasting your time. And it was already all there. And I mean, I'm sorry, you cut me if I talk too much, but
No.
I'm
No, you're
very,
right. Because I see people in the gym I go to has a lot of younger people going, and I watch them, and they just do a lot of sets, and they don't really seem to know why, because they're just following somebody, whose video they saw. Like you said, someone who's got a lot of followers, and if they're on something that I want to use, I'll ask them how many more sets they got, and some of them, they don't even know. I had one girl, she had like pull her hand out and go, one, two, three. She had like eight more sets. It's like they're doing so many sets, they don't have any concept why they're doing what they're doing. They're just following somebody who tells them that's what they should do,
no idea whatsoever. And that's another thing that, another story that I wanted to tell with that book. And again, I was very happy when it came out in France, because a lot of people who not only had no interest in bodybuilding, but they also, it's kind of like very denigrated. It's not very well looked on outside of the bodybuilding world. So, not only they were not interested, they despised it, they hate it. And they liked, thought that, the book was interesting and thrilling, because it helped them realize how that culture, those, crazy, few hundreds of guys at the time, who were inventing a new body, a new relationship to the body, a new relationship to diet, and a new image, and a new relationship to self-confidence, all those things, how it's completely pervaded our world. And I mean, now wherever you go to, there is a gym.
Yes.
You expect, wherever, whichever town you go to, you expect that there's going to be a good, well-equipped gym. If you stay in a hotel, of course there will be a gym, with nice equipment. Whichever supermarket you go to, there's, the high protein, this or that, yogurts, whatever. All the products now are heavy, high protein or keto diet, whatever. It all comes from bodybuilding, and so I think it's interesting to see how these guys who are, at the time it was, I mean, so of course Pumping Iron made it major for maybe 10 years. There was, I would say, between 1976 and 1985, 86, bodybuilding was a major pop cultural phenomenon.
I agree.
Then, little by little, it went back to being this kind of like weird world of crazy guys who we don't really know why they want to look like that, or why they do. But so for those, aside from those 10 years in history, it was just like a community of guys that the whole world looked on and said, what exactly is going on? And they've actually won in the sense that the culture today is completely bodybuilding friendly, I would say. Every actor in Hollywood has a personal trainer, and they all looked like, guys who would have been champions in the 60s or the 70s. And you know, everyone today thinks of, you know, what their workout is going to be and their diet and how much protein they take, etc. It all comes from there. And people have no idea. Like all these guys who go to the gym today, most of them, they don't know where it comes from. They don't know
right.
what it meant at some, they just do it because they were told that it's kind of like good for health. But
right.
they don't even know that way back in the 50s, the doctors thought it was really bad for your health, that you
right.
should keep
right.
as far away from weights as possible. You
yeah.
know, and even with the Olympics now, we've seen, you know, for the last, I would say 30 years, and that's, I also mentioned that in the book, you know, strength training has become major. Like every athlete, whatever their sports, they go to the gym.
Yeah.
But before Arthur Jones and before the 70s, they didn't want to hear of lifting weights. Like if you were a runner, you were a runner. If you were a rugby player, you were a rugby player. You didn't
right.
set foot in the gym. You only did
right.
what they call functional training,
yeah,
not strength training. But so that's what I mean. It's like it's pervaded every aspect of our culture. And literally, I mean, aside from, you know, the community of people like us who are still into it, but most people have no clue what that meant at the time, how much an adventure it was
yeah,
for humanity
yeah.
to have those guys pushing the boundaries of what can be achieved, what can you do with this body and how much you can change it.
Yeah, that's a great point, because you're right. I mean, bodybuilding really was only popular in the mainstream for about that 10-year period, like you said, from the late 70s to like the mid-80s. And then I think what happened was, my opinion, I think the steroids became well known and people, the public realized what steroids were. Like we're back in, I think the 70s and 80s, I remember when Pumping Iron came out, a lot of film critics would just thought that the bodybuilders looked like they did because they worked out with weights and they ate good. They didn't know about steroids. And then once the steroids became public knowledge, I think everybody kind of turned their back on bodybuilding and said, oh, they're all steroid freaks and everything. And now the bodybuilders have gotten so big that now they are freaks, you know, and people just turn.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
The growth hormone, human growth
insulin,
hormone,
yeah.
added to the whole thing. But so going back to the irony, one of the subtitles of the book at some point was From Iron to Irony, Iron to Irony.
Yeah.
Because that's really, I think, the balance between Mike's
yeah.
philosophy and Arnold's philosophy. But so going back to steroids and the mid 80s. Crisis. It's in the mid 80s that steroids become banned, officially banned by the government. They
right.
become classified as, I forgot, like class A drugs or whatever.
Yeah, they moved it up a felony or something.
And that same year, the same year they're banned, there's the Ben Johnson
yes.
affair, you know,
scandal,
so he
yeah.
ripped off his medals when he was one of the greatest champions of all times. And
yeah.
worldwide humiliation, you know, everywhere it's in the news. A guy, you know, an Olympic champion ripped away from his medals because
right.
he took steroids. That same year, Arnold is nominated president or director of the President's Council for Fitness.
Physical fitness, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. By his friend George Bush, because
yeah.
George Bush was in school with the guy who wrote Pumping Iron. So very early on, Arnold was friends with, you know, Bush. And and so that very same year that steroids become like, oh, no, that's a terrible thing. We don't want to have anything to do with that. And look at this bad guy, Ben Johnson. Ooh, bad guy. We're going to rip off his medals. That same year, Arnold, yay, president. Like, what? I'm sorry, but where is
yeah.
the spine? You know, where is the
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah,
sorry.
Going over the book.
I get all riled up by this subject.
Yeah.
I just think it talks so much about what goes on in the world. Like,
yeah.
I mean, you can't look at the facts and not think that there is irony and that, you know, Arnold is a very, very smart player, but, you know.
Yeah. When you were doing the book, isn't it fascinating looking at Arnold, how much he's been able to bypass? I mean, even when he had the big scandal with the maid, he still came back from that. You know, I thought that, I mean, most people that would have ruined their careers, but it seems like he just keeps going. And even like you said, with the steroid issue, nobody really talks about that with him. You know, he just keeps going and going, and
yeah.
people still like idolize him.
Yeah. He's, I mean, so again, my, I wanted to pay tribute to Mike, and my book tells Mike's story from Mike's perspective.
Yeah.
So of course, you know, of course he comes out, I would say, as, but I think that's literally what he was. He was in the traditional romantic hero, you know, the guy with a strong ideal, unbending ideal,
yeah,
bending against the wall, no matter what. And up until his death, you know, straight in his boots, as I don't know if you say in English, but we say in French, straight in his boots, you know, like,
yeah,
hold on to my ideal. And so, yeah, of course, people who read the book, they go like, oh, really? Arnold was like that? And so two things. First, as I said, I write from Mike's perspective, but the reader is free. I mean, obviously, Arnold has won, you know, so every reader is free to decide who they root for. You know, at the end of the day, I have people, you know, when the book came out in France, people who read the book and they still think Arnold is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Because yeah, precisely the other guy, Mike, who they had never heard of before, he was like, well, he was a bit too intense. You know, maybe he should have learned to, you know, fluctuate
politics,
or
yeah,
adapt to his surroundings. And
yeah,
and still, and I think, I mean, as I said, I grew up being an Arnold fan. And I still admire his ability to adapt and understand what goes on around him. And, you know, Mike had his own definition of intelligence, and he thought being intelligent was, you know, believing in some higher first principles and, you know, a certain idea of ethics and truth and science and
rationalization.
But Arnold has another definition of intelligence, which is, I think, way more popular now that I'm a bit older and I have a bit more, you know, experience with the corporate world and the media,
yeah,
and whatever. A lot of people buy more Arnold's definition of intelligence than Mike's, because for a lot of people, being smart means, you know, as they say, read the room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, Arnold's definition of intelligence is about understanding what goes on around you and
yeah,
playing, you know, playing it smart, playing your cards smart. And so Arnold didn't really have any concern for the truth with the big T, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
He was in many ways self-serving. He did a lot of things for the communities around him, including the bodybuilding community,
yeah,
you know, so, but he never really bothered with what were the higher principle or the higher truth. He was just like, well, this is what people want. This is how we're going to do it. And that's opposition of worldviews between the romantic hero, you know, Mike, the guy who believes in one ideal, unbending ideal, eternal ideal, and the other guy who is more, I mean, Ayn Rand, the philosopher, called them the mirror men, you know, men of mirror who reflect whatever people want to see, they, you know, they see in their face. So that's the mirror people. What was I going to say? Yeah, this collision of the two worldviews is the spine of the novel. It's already something that John had written about, John Little. In The Wisdom of Mike Manzer, he made it really clear, this collision of two worldviews between Mike and Arnold. And I think that's why in my view, of course, the book is relevant, but also Mike's personality and life story is relevant to today's world, is that we're still very much faced with that in our political world, you know,
mm-hmm.
and society. You know, I don't want to get too controversial, but, you know, between, you know, Trump, alternate facts, you know, and Black Lives Matter or woke culture,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, everything, every truth is deconstructed or reconstructed, you know.
Yeah.
Every party has their own definition of truth, and no one can really agree on what truth means. Because for the last 40 years, 50 years, the dominant culture has been about breaking down truth in, you know, the cult of subjectivity to each
yeah.
their own truth. You know,
yeah.
what matters is what you believe, how you feel. And that is something that Mike didn't want to hear about. You know, he was like, no, there is one truth. It's science, it's science-based, but basically the whole world evolved towards, and we can see it now, and we can see how destructive it is. The whole world evolved towards a society where everyone has their own truth, everything is subjective, everything depends on how you feel, and you know, there are things that you can't say, and so when you don't have that structure of fact-based, science-based truth, everything collapses. And I think that's what Arnold versus Mike's story says of the world today. And so, sorry, going back to Arnold, the second thing that I wanted to say is that nothing that I write about Arnold has not been published before. So people who read it, they go like, what? Seriously? He did that?
Yeah.
Well, it's, I didn't make it up. It was either in his autobiography or in the non-authorized biography that came out after the Nate story, or in, I don't know, Muscle Wars, or in Randy Roach. We didn't talk about Randy. Great guy, spent a lot of time talking to me, and amazing book, you know, Muscle, Smoke, and Mirror.
Yeah.
Great book, very helpful for me. You know, everything that I write about Arnold was already published in these books or blogs or, you know, whatever. So
is that where you got most of your information from, Nicholas? I mean, the interviews and then also other articles and books and about Mike?
Well, so there is a long list of sources at the end of the book.
Okay.
It was, you know, I spent a lot of time, many years writing it and researching it. So, yeah, all the books that I've mentioned, great resource. Especially Muscle, Smoke, and Mirror, and you know, Muscle Wars. So that was major. But most importantly, two things: Mike's own writing.
Okay,
you know, Mike wrote a lot of articles between I think 1977 and 1984 or five.
Right.
For Weider, you know, he wrote a lot of articles, and his articles were very rich in the sense that, again, as I said earlier, it was not just about how to train. He shared a lot of his own life, memories, cultural references, books that he liked. And so, you know, it was all like, oh, so he quotes that writer. Maybe I should go read what that guy wrote and see how it fits in Mike's own mind. So that was, I had a chance to get access to his own writing. In San Francisco, there is a place called The Magazine, which is a 4 or 5 story building, which has one of the world's largest archive of muscle magazines.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
It's called The Magazine in San Francisco. Wow.
Yeah. From the late 1900s, from the late 1800s, sorry.
Wow.
Late 19th century. All the way to 1994.
No kidding.
I don't ask me, but they stopped in 94. They stopped collecting the Muscle Mag. So literally every issue of Iron Man, Muscle Builder, then Muscle and Fitness.
That's amazing.
What was the other? There was another major publication, Flex, that was a little bit later.
Yeah, your development.
And so, I mean, I had access to all of that. And I spent literally days, weeks, every day I would go to the magazine. They had set up a little office for me on the last floor. Regular customers did not have access to these archives. And I read every single issue, you know, of those magazines, especially the years where Mike was active. But also, you know, so I went, for instance, I went back to, Mike always tells the story of how, like many guys who love bodybuilding, there was always this one click moment where, you know, they're 10 or 11 years old, they go to the store, they see the Muscle Physique magazine with whoever on the cover.
Yeah.
And that's when it goes click and they go like, that's what I want to look like. And that's how it starts. So Mike has always told the story. And even though he's kind of like sometimes changed the name of who was on the cover, basically, I've been told, and I'm 100% sure it was Bill Pearl, not Steve Reeves, Bill Pearl on the cover. And so I went and I found the issue that Mike saw in that year when he went to the drugstore with his mom and he saw Bill Pearl on the cover. And yeah. I read the whole issue because I was like, this is, you know, this is what Mike read when he was 11. And that's what kind of like, figured his fires in his mind. And it's a fascinating issue because there is this editorial by Bob Hoffman, which is called The President is Worried. And it's Bob Hoffman explaining that the physical test that the Eisenhower had installed in the high schools, the American kids were doing really, really bad and way worse than European kids or I don't know which other nations he mentions. And so Bob Hoffman says, well, this is a very serious issue. We can't have a nation of men who are not strong and fit. And then he goes on explaining that the whole society is collapsing because no one, you know, knows how to eat and how to train. And so he says our fight at Strength and Health, that's the other title I was looking for. Our fight at Strength and Health magazine is, you know, to make a strong America. And I mean, when you read that, I mean, of course, you recognize some of the talks of today, but most importantly, when you read it with the eyes of an 11 years old in the early 60s, you know, Mike, and you go like, oh my God, this is what's going on, and this is why I have to lift weight. I mean, so very early on, Mike had that feeling that lifting weights was not just about getting, you know, big biceps or pecs. It was way more important than that in his mind. It was something way more with way higher ideals.
Yeah.
Than just getting bigger. It was about building a better society where men and women, because we haven't talked about women's bodybuilding, but he wrote a lot about it later in his life. But you know, like where individuals take charge of what is given to them, i.e., the body and the mind, mm-hmm. and try to, you know, take it to its higher potential.
Yeah,
you know, and in Bob Hoffman's editorial at the time, he writes, "Most of us are only half awake," you know? and Mike goes like, well, this is, I mean, when you look around you, this is going back to what we were saying earlier. A lot of people go through their lives
right.
without really knowing why or what for, what goes on. You know, they just go through the weekends. Yeah. And Mike, very early on, wrote about how he had that feeling looking around him in the small town where he lived, and then even later in California, that he had that feeling that people were just living. He talks of blighted lives. You know, like lives that are very just limited, and people don't look across the border. They don't look right. what's beyond the limits. And he very early on had that understanding. Our duty as men, women, and human beings is to explore the limits of what's possible with our minds and with our bodies and,
yeah.
and the whole world. So, So anyway, I'm sorry.
You think Mike? Did Mike learn a lot of his philosophy or his way of life from his dad? Because his dad was very straightforward and told the truth and all that, right?
Yeah. We know very little of, and I say we as a collective, we, not a royal. But, you know, me and other people who have tried to inquire into Mike's life, we know very little of Mike's father's life, but from everything that I could gather, and again, part of it is from Mike's own writing. Mm-hmm. Some of it is from Dave, you know, who spent time at Mike's family house when they were teenagers and they were playing together. But also, I talked to one of Mike's cousins in Ephrata. I met this woman who was very, very sweet, very kind. She didn't remember much, but she shared whatever she remembered of Mike's childhood. And yeah, from what I could gather, Mike's father was a, you know, ex-military, had been fought in the war. He had fought in the war.
Right.
He was a hard worker, hardworking, working class man. Very, you know, like I mean, it sounds a little bit cliche, but yeah, a lot of the guys from the 50s, you know, coming back from the war, you know, they knew what they had fought for. They knew what the West stood for, or at least they had a strong belief in what they wanted the West to stand for. Uh-huh. And they basically just thought that, you know, America is the land of freedom. If you work hard, you're going to get rewarded. You know, just do your job properly, be a straightforward, or what can I say? How can I say that? You know, stand tall and
From what I remember reading, I remember Mike was saying he was a man of principle, and you know, you stood up to your principles and you said what you believed in. And so I thought that's where Mike got a lot of his, you know, philosophy about life. And then he just carried that through for the rest of his life, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And so that's another thing that, you know, I think maybe we can mention to your listeners and viewers is one of the things that I learned, writing the book and inquiring, investigating into Mike's life, is that, you know, he didn't collapse after the 1980 Olympia. You know, that, again, going back to what we were saying earlier, if you're interested in Mike Munzer, you can go online, you will find a lot of things. A lot of the things that you find online are rumors or hearsay, or people who've just like met Mike maybe one afternoon in their lives, and you know, and they will write whatever they heard. And so basically the legend goes, he collapsed after 1980. So he was a superstar.
Destroyed his life.
Came back in 1980, beat him, and then boom, Mike is down and never. That's totally not the case.
Right.
You know, he kept going. He was actually way more famous after the 1980 Olympia than before, because he was every magazine's cover, like everyone, you know, throughout the world, like they put him on the cover, not Arnold. So that doesn't say that everyone agrees that he should have won. Everyone agrees that Arnold should not have won. Some people think that it should have been either Mike or Roy Callender or Chris Dickerson. But I'm not saying that everyone agreed that Mike should have won, but he was on every magazine's cover. And the fact that there was this scandal, that a lot of people were not happy with the results, and that he was very vocal about it, gave him even more of a platform to, you know, promote his own version of high intensity training, etc. So he kept going. He had a lot of projects. He launched the first video VHS at the time, bodybuilding program. I mean, that was quite a venture, very, very daring venture, audacious venture at the time. And then he launched Workout magazine, his own magazine, which in many ways can be viewed as a precursor to a Men's Health. You know, Men's Health magazine?
Yeah.
When you read Workout, the very few issues that were ever published, because it was unplugged after a few months, it's like an embryo of what Men's Health is going to be later on.
Yeah.
And if you think that Men's Health is the biggest success in men's magazines of the late 20th century, early 21st century, that tells you how much of a visionary Mike was. You know, he had that intuition that people didn't want to buy muscle and fitness. Most people didn't want to buy muscle and fitness. Most people didn't want to look like you know, the muscle freaks, but they were interested in working out and in staying fit. And so he had that intuition. So all that to say that he kept going for many years after the 1980 Olympia. His fires were still strong. He had projects, visionary projects, but there was a lot of things that happened in his private life that little by little added to the first major blow of a 1980 Olympia. One of them being his father's death. That's how I connect to what you were saying earlier. So, and I think it does say a lot of how important Mike's father was in his life, even though they had a very distant relationship. You know, obviously, when you have a personality like the ones that you've described of Mike's father, and you know, and I confirm that this is also what I've been told that he was. You're not, you know, you're not the kind to be all lovey-dovey with your son, and you know, and all, Also, Mike's father disapproved of bodybuilding for most of Mike's year. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, guys in the, again, most guys in the 50s didn't approve of bodybuilding. It was it was something for weirdos and freaks and gays. And the doctor.
Didn't Mike's dad introduce him to a friend of his that was into bodybuilding, and they kind of like mentored Mike a little bit?
Yeah. That's a big part of the first part
of the book. Yeah,
of the novel. It's Mike's friendship with his father's friend called Myers. So I think I might have to change the name. I'm sorry, I don't really remember because I was. You know, I wrote it 7 years ago. So,
yeah.
But anyway, yeah, Mike's father had a friend who was a lifter from York, not from York, but he was working out at York, sometimes at York, sometimes in his own garage. And he was one of those, you know, few guys at the time who were training, but Mike's father didn't even know that the guy was lifting.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because at the time it was just not something that you did out in the open.
Yeah,
of course, there were people who did it out in the open, but in the mainstream population, it was not something that you shouted, you know, around or that. So, and then when Mike told his father that he wanted to get the York Barbell Special 12, you know, the kit that everyone ordered at the time, Mike's father was not really happy about it because he had a very negative view, which again was dominant at the time of what weightlifting was about.
Yeah.
And then he talked to his friend, Myers, and the guy says, well, yeah, I mean, I do it. And so, because Mike's father was like, I don't want my son to turn gay. and he said, well, I mean, look at me, dude, you know me. And the guy, what, you lift weights? And say, yeah, of course I do. And that's how the whole thing started.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you for Nicholas for the interview about his new book, Mr. America. And just like I said, check out the link below. And I'll put the link on Amazon on where you can purchase the book. It's only about $20. And like I said, it's a 600-page novel about the life of Mike Mentzer. All right, so before I let you guys go, I want to read an article for you. This comes from the April 1976 issue of Muscle Builder and Power. This is actually the first magazine I ever bought. I bought this Muscle Builder, and I bought a Iron Man with Boyer Coe on the cover, which was right around the same year and the same month. So it's pretty interesting that the Mentzer's first article was the first magazine I bought. So it's called Mentzer's Contraction Control Training, and it's written by Gene Mose. It says, one of America's fastest rising stars believes in training every muscle to failure, not fatigue. It's the Weider forced rep system with a vengeance. All right. They already named it. They already had a Weider training principle for Mike's training. It says, in one of the most startling training concepts to appear in years, Mike Mentzer challenges the high set system used by the superstars today. With intense concentration and controlled movements, he proves you can cut workout time drastically. Most bodybuilders don't know how to train, claims Mike. In the following interview, he describes the system that made full use of the Weider reverse gravity and the force reps principles of training. He trains to failure instead of fatigue on exercises in a way that preserves enthusiasm and ensures progress. 1 1/2 hour workouts 3 times a week may be the contest training of the future, says Big Mike. Gene, your arm looks really thick from all angles, Mike. What does it measure, and how many times a week do you train it? Mike, it measures 19 1/4 inches cold. I work it 3 times a week. I work all body parts 3 times a week. That frequency tends to keep my metabolism and enthusiasm up. Gene, how do you schedule your training? What body parts do you work with your arms? Mike, on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I work biceps and triceps together right after deltoids. Gene, that combination could work well for you because you are naturally wide. Narrow guys have to work delts and lats together. 2/3 of the shoulder girdle is the scapula. When you work deltoids first, the ligaments are warmed up fully so that when you do the lat exercises, the stretching action helps build shoulder width. Narrow guys should work delts and lats together and chest and arms together. Arnold and Larry Scott both work delts and arms together, and neither of them display great width. How long does your deltoid workout take, Mike? How many sets do you do? I've never timed it, but I only do five sets. Five sets, that's all? I work them very hard, though. I use the negative resistance principle. I work with a training partner. After I push a weight up, I'll have my partner apply hand pressure downward on the weight so that I'm working against resistance through the entire lowering movement. When I begin to weaken and pushing up after a few reps, then my partner does the reverse and applies upward pressure. The process becomes a combination negative resistance, force reps exercise. There are no dead spots in any movement. I'm working against maximum resistance, both going and returning. When I finish a set, I can hardly raise my arms by themselves. After a brief rest, I'm ready to go again. How many total sets do you do for arms? Five sets. Five for triceps, five for biceps. That's hard to believe. You have great arms. You work arms following deltoids. Guys with exceptional arms usually have developed their own unique way of training them. What are the details of such a low set arm program? I start off with preacher bench curls using a fairly wide grip with my elbows in tight, palms out. I pick a weight I can do 8 to 10 reps with and work to failure. I use the straight side of the bench and lean over it. I go full lower and peak biceps work. I get full lower and peak biceps work. I do three sets, resting just long enough between sets to permit an effort equal to the original set. After that, I go to seated concentration curls. I hold my elbow against the inside thigh and supinate the hand at the peak of the flexion. I keep my eye on the muscle as I curl, and when it starts to ball up, then I supinate. I hold the peak position for 2 seconds and follow this with controlled lowering. I make full use of the downward force by resisting it all the way to the starting position. Again, I don't waste return movements. I do 2 sets, 8 to 10 reps, and go to failure. What else do you do for biceps? That's it. Five sets, sometimes less. I can get pumped on one set, really. My arms are dead after five sets, so why do I need more? The muscles had it. You don't believe in 15 or 20 sets per body part? I used to do 25 sets for biceps. I responded on high sets, but I'm also responding on low sets, so why waste the time and energy? What about your triceps? What exercises? The same sort of thing. I start off with tricep pushdowns on the vertical pulley with a bar, very close grip, very strict. I push down and as close to the body as possible. Straightening the elbow gets the outer head, while pushing down gets the inner head. I do 2 or 3 sets, 8 to 10 reps. I follow these with parallel bar dips. I dip deep as far as I can go without tearing out my shoulders. I do 2 sets. This is the arm routine you now use. How much of your present arm development do you attribute to this routine? Did you have up to 19 inches before you went on this routine? The biggest I had then before was 18 and three quarters, but I was 5 pounds heavier. Now I weigh 199 with 19 and a quarter and more muscular. Would you recommend this kind of training for the person just getting started with perhaps a year of training or less? I think it's ideal. Without the proper metabolism and enthusiasm, I think 15 or 20 sets would tear down his motivation. Five sets would be better. Does this mean you have reformed your training philosophy? If I can get what I want with five sets, why not? I save time and energy. How long's your workout on the delt arm day? About 1.5 hours. How can it take so long to do so few sets? Well, that's my entire body workout. How is that? Don't you work out every day? No, I only work out 3 times a week. Mike, it sounds like we're getting a snow job. In what sequence do you train your body parts then? Well, I start with the biggest body parts first and work down to the smallest: legs, back, chest, delts, arms, and abdominals. Do you step up your training before a show? No, definition is a matter of diet. I alter my diet while still keeping my training heavy. On this type of program, do you feel that the days of rest between workouts makes it work? Yes, along with regular sleep, 6.5 to 8 hours. If a fellow wants to go on a specialization program to put an inch on his arms, how would this system work for him when he barely gets a pump in five sets? Well, the way I do them, I can get a pump in one set. I work until the weight falls out of my hand. Bob Birdsong works like that, but he uses light weights. That's relative. I use as much weight as I can for the required number of reps, working to failure on each set. On the concentration curl, I use about 45 pounds, and on the preacher bench, 120. I follow the Weider peak isolation principle, doing everything strict and peaking. However, I'll follow the Weider force rep system in the last rep or two, either by myself or with a partner assistance. Do you believe in the supersets principle? Yes, I use it for periods of time, even with my system. I don't let my body get used to any single system. I prefer to jolt it out of any lazy habits. You can't do too many sets per body part when you work your whole body in one day. What point would you stress for getting the most out of this program? Complete extension and contraction with each movement, working the muscle through its complete range of motion, and going to failure. The idea of five sets of body part three times a week is not new. A lot of fellows have started out that way, but as soon as they begin to make gains, they increase the number of sets until they got to the point where they were overtrained. I did the same thing. As my progress slowed, I advanced the number of sets until progress stopped altogether. We all get stuck with that psychology. If a little is good, more is better. How wrong? Now that I'm back to 3 days a week, I'm gaining like crazy. Do you train breathless or do you wait for your oxygen to return to normal after a set? I wait for recovery before I go on to the next set. If I can't do well, if I hustle it, when you're in good shape, you recover quickly. Do you think a fellow at the intermediate stage of training can benefit from the Weider fourth reps principle? Yes. What do you think of the tendency of some guys to do 30 or 40 sets per body part? I don't think they'll gain. Next year, I'll look as good as Arnold. Next month, Mike tells us how he uses contraction control training for his other body sections. Yeah, we mentioned that in the interview with Nicholas, where he said, next year, I'll look as good as Arnold. And as Nicholas said, he said Armand Tanney was the author, but it was actually Gene Mosé. And he said, Armand asked him, are you sure you want me to put that in there? And he did. All right. That was interesting. All right, guys. Well, that's it for the show. So join us next week when we'll have part two of our interview with Nicholas Kemla, the author of the new book, Mr. America, a novel about the life of Mike Mentzer. All right. Until next week, train hard, stay safe, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.